Hello, this is a recording of a forum which occurred on June 12th, 1997, here at Holden Village. This forum has to do with asking anything that you want to ask of a state senator. State Senator John Marty will answer as best he can. And he is leading it, so let's tune in on the forum.
And tonight, Jackie, you...
A town meeting.
Town meeting.
Yeah.
And so I recognize a lot of people in the room are Minnesotans, and I will tell people for the record that I am John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota, and former gubernatorial candidate, and been in office for close to 11 years, and the topic tonight is whatever people want to ask about related to politics or government or whatever. And if we wanted to start with stadiums, we could do that since we discussed it outside a few minutes ago. But otherwise, open to anything. Would you like to start with stadiums?
No, don't start there. We'll
never get off of that.
No, we can dedicate the last 10 minutes or so.
Okay.
I came with a question.
Sure.
That is wondering what advice you would give to, I guess, the lay person on how to just keep on top of what's happening in the legislature. And I know, you know, Nils, my partner, was interested in welfare reform, asked for a copy of the bill, and it's 200 pages long, in a language that I don't necessarily speak. Just wondering what... I guess I do hear some about different phone lines or ways that you can get some copies of things, but wondering what sort of suggestions you might have.
Okay. Well, first of all, in terms of getting copies of bills, getting access to government documents, it's one area where there really has been a lot of progress in the last 2 or 3 years because of internet. And I think every bill introduced in Minnesota, including the newest versions, are now available on the internet. And I think we're certainly not the only state doing that. Apparently our computer systems don't quite have the system down right, because most legislation in any state is in the form of modifying current law, so it's hard to tell what in our state underlined words are new language, and crossed out words, strike through words are being deleted from the law, and words that aren't underlined or stricken are existing law. And so, but somehow the computers, it's very hard to read the stricken words on the internet, and so they haven't figured out a good system for that, and therefore it's not entirely clear to people what they're reading, if it's new language or language being crossed out or what. But I am told it's getting better, and therefore to track things like that, it's getting much easier than it was years ago, and in most states you can get it pretty quickly. But that doesn't solve, it's, as you said, language that you may read a 200-page bill and the substance you're interested in is the operative language that you're concerned about is one paragraph buried deep in it, and you may never find it if you look. I had one bill of mine folded into another bill, and by the time it was done, it was just the last section of the bill, the things where we repeal certain parts of the law. It was just repealing a part of the law. So it just added one more chapter number to what was being repealed. And you could look for that and look for that, and the summaries of the bill would tell you it was in there. But where is it? Well, it was just a crossed out or a number being added to the repealing language. So to get the substance in a meaningful way, there is no simple way that you can tell somebody for whatever the subject here so you can get that substance. The media certainly doesn't cover it. I'd expect them to do better than they do, but you couldn't expect them to cover every good old thing. The best way in general would be to, if there's particular issues of interest to you, it's to be participate in some way, shape, or form in some organization that cares about that. If you take the issue of welfare reform, a number of groups who track such issues very carefully, and they can express the controversial parts very well and what the concerns are. And it's through organizations and newsletters, and more of them are getting more active with either phone tree types of things or numbers you call into to find out information. And unfortunately, in a democracy that relies on people being well-informed, we have no good way of informing people. And so organizations that track things, that may be the best way, but again, if you're interested in every kind of issue, there's no simple way other than trying to follow the media. And again, at least in Minnesota, the major newspapers, a couple of the TV stations have their own internet stops now, and you can track it on there, and they will do more in-depth reporting on politics in there and legislative action. So I think that it's coming to a situation where people with high-tech capabilities and internet access will be able to get more, but that's not going to answer anything for helping the mass of the public be informed.
From your perspective, can you suggest or recommend organizations you think do a good job interpreting that to the public?
It would sort of depend, and at the state level type of thing, on each individual state. It also depends on the issue. I mean, I look in Minnesota, I tell people who are interested in agriculture issues, there are two groups who do voting records on members of the legislature, Farmers Union and Farm Bureau, and if you're anything to do with agriculture, you have a sense where those two organizations are coming from. Usually one's over here and one's over there. And so your voting record on ag issues from Farmers Union, if it's high, it's going to be low from Farm Bureau and vice versa. But those groups, in other words, groups you support for other reasons you believe in, environmental organizations, Sierra Club or Isaac Walton League or other things, depending on the type of issue, I'd say groups that care about a specific issue, if they are, they're the first ones you turn to. Groups you trust, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of social, in Minnesota, there are a number of groups related to religious community that have interest in various types of legislation. The Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is a Catholic, Protestant, Jewish coalition. The Lutheran Church in Minnesota has a small coalition. I guess what I'd say is that some of the groups who are very interested in legislation may not have a good system for informing their members or the public about their concerns. They may not have that, but if it's a group you believe in, you might encourage them to do that, because it does make it much more effective for them to help lobby on those things.
In theory, we have a representative form of government, and in theory, you're elected to represent your constituents. And I know at times when there's an issue which you feel is an issue of conscience, you would hopefully vote your conscience, not necessarily the sentiment of your constituents. I'm wondering if you would talk about death penalty, the fact that, according to popular polls anyway, an overwhelming number of people in the state support it. How do you feel about the present tactic, as I understand what's happening in the legislature, is that they're trying to keep it from even being voted on, because if they have to vote on it, then the issue is, you know, how do you respond to your constituents who may want it? And yet, you know, if we have a representative form of government, and if that's what the people want, how do you... You know, is your conscience more important to the well-being of the state or whatever that you should block it? Or do you just say, I take this stand, and if people feel that strongly, they can vote me out of office? Or just respond.
Sure. It's a major issue that's been going, being discussed as long as there have been representative forms of democracy. And as you point out, it's not a direct democracy, it's a representative form. And I do take very seriously, it is my obligation to represent my constituents. I don't take that either side of this debate believes that it's not, you shouldn't represent your constituents. It's a question of how you represent them. My read on it is I'm not supposed to take a poll of them on every issue and try and vote majority opinion. I'm supposed to use my best judgment, do what I think is right, try and persuade the public that that's the right thing. That's where the leadership comes in, trying to move the public to that. And if I fail to do that and they feel I'm not serving their best interest, they vote for somebody else. So I think that I can say I don't think the issue is whether we're to represent them or not, but how we represent them. And in representing them, those who take the position opposite of mine, well, what I should do is find out where your constituents stand and do that. Well, first of all, they very seldom, the people who want to do that and those who claim to be doing that, very seldom represent majority opinion. They represent majority of
vocal
constituents or majority of people who see that as a major factor in electoral politics. Take gun control. National polls and polls in Minnesota and most states will say somewhere between 2/3 and 9/10 of the public favors various forms of gun control. There's 10% of the public, let's say, and this is just pulled out of the top of my head on that percentage, but let's say 10% of the public considers gun control a key issue to the extent that they vote on that issue. Maybe solely, some, maybe 1% votes solely on that issue, but we'll say 10% votes with that a major factor in their electoral decisions. And of those 10%, 9.5% or more vote against anyone who votes in favor of any form of gun control. Well, the people who vote with the public will on gun control would be favoring some forms of gun control. The people who say they're doing what the people want, the ones who are trying to represent their poll of their constituents and whatever, are voting against any form of gun control, and basically they're voting for the vocal minority in effect. And on top of that, the other problem I see with that form of doing things is the public has contradictory interests. That's not surprising. It's not bad. I think most of us would like to pay less taxes and get more services from government. And the U.S. Congress, somebody once said, you know, they've done a very good job of giving the people just what they want. They want to cut taxes and spend more. And it causes deficits, which the public also doesn't want. And the public's not being inconsistent, it's just conflicting desires in them and us and everyone. And it might be our responsibility as elected officials to weigh those things. It's also our responsibility, I would suggest, to study the issues more. When we can't get any significant information about an issue, well, maybe as a public at large, maybe the job of the people we elect is to use their education, their experience, their training, their time to study the issues to learn. And that, frankly, may make a more informed process, which is one of the main reasons I oppose what Washington and many other states have, an initiative and referendum process where you put everything up to a yes or no vote with no chance to amend it. And again, last time we were here in 93, there was an initiative that basically was going to take all the fiscal issues the Washington legislature had passed that year and undo them all. I don't remember quite how it was worded. I never saw it, but everybody from Washington seemed to know all about it. And it was to undo everything the past legislature had done. And that's a great cynical attitude about government that is not uncommon these days, but it's not very thoughtful public policy. And I'd like to think that you have a process where we have campaigns and decisions on issues that are more than bumper sticker like slogans and vote yes or vote no. And then finally, to the death penalty issue, having given that as background how I look at the issues, I do not support a death penalty, and I have never supported a death penalty. And I can take some solace in the fact that even though I know a majority of the public does support a death penalty, if you word the question a little bit differently, you can get a different response. The typical way you get a response where a majority is not calling for the death penalty is that, do you favor a death penalty for first-degree murder, particularly brutal first-degree murder cases? Do you favor a death penalty? And then if you say, which of the following options do you prefer, death penalty or life in prison without parole or life in prison or this and this and this, the one that wins most is the life in prison without parole. Basically, people want to be kept safe from it, and there's a growing trend towards revenge, certainly, and I haven't heard anything new about the Timothy McVeigh sentencing yet. I don't know if anything's happened.
Closing arguments today.
Today. And I would not be surprised to see if you took a poll on how many Americans think you ought to be executed and believe it might be 80% or more. And I don't support that. And Mario Cuomo is another politician who may have gone down to defeat on that issue. And he was very upfront about it. He vetoed death penalty bills year after year. And he won a couple of re-elections despite that. But Pataki, when he was running against him last time, continued to make it a big issue. And was that the decisive one? Well, in a close race, everyone's the decisive issue. So. Yes, sir.
Do you think President Clinton will get the debt laid down before he leaves office?
The debt down? Yes, I think the debt will keep going down. I think Clinton and Congress both have a lot of conflicting feelings about it, but they are, the national debt will not go down, but the deficit, in other words, how much we're increasing the national debt will go down. And if we, at some point, eliminate the deficit, then in time, because of inflation, we work down the amount of the national debt. I think that that's an important issue because, in a sense, we are spending our children's and future generations' money, but the question is, are we stopping stealing from our future generations by cutting back on our kids and others and leaving a deficit in terms of society, in terms of preparation, in terms of education, in terms of the human capital or human infrastructure that we should be preparing the next generation with? So I guess as one who thinks we ought to be working at addressing the national deficit, I don't think we should be doing it the way this Congress and President are doing. And I have a feeling that the public supports it. I mean, the public in any poll say they don't like the national deficit. But they also may not. It was, again, that conflicting pressure. We want lower taxes and we want more help with this that has kept it from being the front burner issue until now. And I'm afraid and very disappointed in the way we are addressing it. I think the Atlantic Monthly a couple months ago had a nice article by Peter Adelman, who was best known nationally, I think, is the spouse of Marion Wright Adelman, the head of the Children's Defense Fund, and an incredible woman. He was an assistant commissioner, I believe, Department of Human Services, or Health and Human Services at the national level. And he resigned over Clinton signing the welfare reform bill last year. And he wrote a nice cover story in Atlantic Monthly several months ago. The worst thing Bill Clinton ever did, and he subtitled it, how with one stroke of a pen he took the worst welfare system in the world and made it even worse. And I think that a lot of our attitude right now is we're going to cut this deficit, which is good, but the way we're going to do it is at the expense of people, and that's a real robbing from the next generation as well.
What about all the proclivity to look into people's bedrooms?
People will get hurt from it, and people are being hurt right now. My talk tomorrow, which I don't know if the title reflects it in any way, but it takes a village to raise a child, was meant, the subject matter I intend to talk about there is human investment. And I don't think the problem with our government, our great society programs, as they were called in the past, isn't that we fought the war on poverty and lost, it's we surrendered in the war on poverty. And we certainly had some very poorly designed programs, but they're not trying to fix the programs, they're just eliminating things. And I know when we have, what percentage of kids now that don't have any basic health care in this country, and there's so many pressing needs out there that are not being met. People are hurt, and people are getting hurt. And there are many things that government could cut and should cut, and many other ways we could do things, but the people who have the least voice are the ones who get hurt. And that's what does happen under this. Anyway, I'm sorry we had two questions at once.
That's no problem. What about all the interest that the press and the public has in all the activities of politicians and military people and what they do outside of their job or outside of their elected responsibilities? What effect do you think that has? First of all, is it a good thing to have that kind of prurient interest or whatever? And what do you think that's doing to our legislative system, to our public's perception of government and so forth?
It's a good question. I don't know that I have a perfect answer to it. I think you suggested part of the reason there is a prurient interest in people's private lives, and you can talk at length about tax policy that has a major impact on people's lives, and yeah, they care about when they see their tax bill, but do they care about following the debate? No, that's boring, but somebody gets in a sex scandal or some other kind of thing, and boy, that's really interesting. And the military, I mean, there's so many issues of what goes on in the military, and nobody pays attention, and then you have the adultery case or the sexual, the rape cases and everything else, and there's certainly big issues, but the media and the public pays far more attention to them than to other things. Does that mean they shouldn't pay any? Let's get to politicians, take the military out of this. But in the political world, does that mean the public should not pay attention to those things? I don't want to suggest that that's exactly right either, because something about somebody's private life may give some indications about if they're dishonest in small things, if they're dishonest in their private life, if they're a bad person, however we want to define bad person, if they are dishonest in private life, do we trust them with public life? And I think that's a very legitimate reason to have some interest in it, but let me caution several things. One, sometimes the people who do the worst things in their private life are the best at covering it up. Number two, how much priority should that be? I mean, if somebody is a jerk, is of a personality, they're brutal, they don't have many friends, and their family life is in shambles because of them, and they're just not what we call a good person, but they really do care and work hard and do things right in their public job, I'd suggest that's what we're electing them for. In other words, we're not electing somebody for their personal life. And we don't elect saints. We elect human beings and sinners and people who have all sorts of flaws. And we should keep that in mind. But beyond that, I don't want to say that it's totally off consideration, because again, somebody who really does care about people and who personally does that, you might learn something about that. That's the reason why campaign literature, people put their family photos in there. That's why they talk about community involvement. They do other things. Legitimately, they want to promote good things, but I mentioned in talk the other day when we were talking about political imaging and political images and sound bites and so on, how candidates can, those most anti-family candidates in their personal lives are the ones who are sometimes able to create this image that's the exact opposite of it. And so in addition to saying let's weigh how much priority this should have, let's also recognize that we only have partial information about people's private lives, and sometimes the ones you'd be most disgusted at are the ones who may come across the best.
There's a pretty good editorial in the latest New York Times on that issue.
On that issue, just this week or so?
Yeah, just the last one.
What was the...
Well, basically that we ought to do it. We ought to do things that curtail the behavior, but not just destroy people's careers because of their private life.
In the Minnesota legislature, for those of you not from Minnesota, last year we had 5, 6, 7 quote ethics scandals. Some guy who was a kleptomaniac and shoplifted several times and resigned from the legislature. He lied about it too, which is not surprising. When you break the law, you might lie about it and try to hide it and all sorts of other things, and the individual clearly needed help. He was caught for one instance, and then while he was waiting trial was caught for another one, and so clearly the individual had some serious problems and needed help. And I'm not going to defend that individual. It was not the one of the brightest lights in the legislature, but nevertheless it's a question of where do you draw the line. How important is somebody's wrongdoing there? If you in private life do something that is dishonest or hurtful to somebody, that ought to be a factor. But when you do something, when Sharon said, well, people get hurt from some of the ways we deal with government programs, people get hurt. Well, when you're affecting hundreds of thousands or millions of people through something, that ought to weigh something too. And so it's a thing that I think the public ought to consider, but I don't think they should consider the fact that a member of the legislature who was caught shoplifting and somebody else was caught drunk driving and some other things like that, that therefore politicians are corrupt. There are some corrupt politicians. Yeah. They're pretty much reflection of the human race in many ways. And we're, again, as I said, we're not electing perfect people. And I guess the voters have to make their call. I just hope that they don't feel either that it's totally irrelevant or that it should be the only factor or the main one.
Do you have some perception of what caused, I maybe covered this already, but I came in late. What caused is the public's perception of government is bad? I know the militia groups are so paranoid about this, and somehow I think the gun lobbies are tied in too. I don't know.
There's a whole lot. Some of that may be historical. We came here and we're more independent. The historians and sociologists over the years have always talked how the American psyche is somewhat different than other countries, and people came here to get away from government oppression. So some of it might be historical. Some of it is clearly groups that do not want. I mean, our government, more than most other democracies in the world, is funded very much with heavy impact of special interest money. Many of the interests are ones that don't want government regulating their environmental quality. They don't want government taxing them. They don't want other things in. And I would suggest that they've colored the whole debate very heavily in recent years with media campaigns doing that. Plus, politicians get a sense nobody likes taxes. And politicians try and respond to that, and they point out how they're going to make things better. And because people see waste, when you see the common stereotypical news story of the 3-person road crew to fill a pothole, one drives the truck and sits there and parks while the other two get out, one hands the shovel to the other guy and watches him do that, and that's not unheard of. It does happen. and everybody sees it, and I guess fortunately the TV crews and others follow that, and they try and point out the scandals and abuses that way. So people see that, and they assume 90% of the money in government's wasted. So they don't like the money being wasted, all those things, and then they think that the people who run government are crooks. They do think politicians sometimes rank above used car salesmen, which also have a nasty reputation. Sometimes they rank below them. But that's partly because of campaign ads. Again, if one candidate calls the other one all kinds of vicious things, and that one calls the other one all kinds of vicious things, you listen to what both of them say and you conclude, hey, everybody around here is bad people, and if bad people are making decisions and you see the waste and you hear about waste, therefore, let's get government off our back, let's take government away. And the militia type of movement, I think, is just an extreme of that. I think that the average citizen doesn't want anything to do with the militias and the anti-anything to do with government. And we're going to arm ourselves and take over we're going to protect ourselves from the government. But the average citizen very much thinks everything they have was due to their hard work, and everything anybody else gets from government is a handout. I mean, student loan programs, GI Bill, all kinds of other things. Good things. Well, that's just because, I mean, the head of Minnesota's Chamber of Commerce a decade ago was a former DFL state senate, Democratic state senator, who resigned from the Senate and took a job as head of the Chamber of Commerce. They had an ad campaign about a few years before I was in the legislature, and they ran these ads, don't take a hike. It was an anti-tax ad campaign. And why is Minnesota 3 times the national average in income taxes? And why do we pay this much more in commercial property taxes than this? And why do we do this? And anybody reading the ad had the clear impression that Minnesota total tax burden was about 2 to 3 times the national average for state taxes. Well, we are above the national average, about 14%. Not 300%, but 14%. And that has been hyped by business community very much on why we should do this. And the head of that group, this, again, former Democratic state senator, was a graduate of Minnesota's public schools, the University of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota Law School. Had many benefits that were paid for by the taxpayers. But we don't talk about those things. We just talk about how government is ripping us off. And welfare recipients are a good bashing tool. We used to be able to talk about, you know, if you want to do it, let's raise concern about the kids. Anybody who thinks welfare recipients are lazy, there are some who are lazy. There's some working people who are lazy. There are lots of people who are lazy. But most of us don't think that people who are above retirement age or people who are under 5 should be working. And we don't usually think of those who aren't working as lazy. And you used to be able to say, well, let's at least be concerned about the kids, but now society, the debate's gone so far that I think we're even losing that. And, well, have their parents go out and get jobs and not be so lazy. And dysfunctional parents who may be addicted to something or maybe for health or other reasons unable to hold down a job, that's their problem or somebody else's problem. So it's a whole chain of things. I mean, that's a long answer, but I don't think there is any one thing. I think your observation is exactly right about what's happening. But it's no one cause. Yes, sir.
What are your viewpoints on keeping very fragile babies alive no matter the cost?
Keeping premature babies? Okay.
No matter
what the cost. And when we get into that sort of issue, there are, with the medical cost issues, first of all, I think the number one greatest cost in the medical system, they say, is the last 2 weeks of life or so, or the last 2 months of life, where we spend an extreme amount of money to keep people alive. And I think, first of all, we've got to be very careful in how we do it. I would be very leery of government saying, no, we're not going to keep very premature babies alive, regardless of the cost, or people at the long end of life. Yeah. What I like to see happening, and I think there is a very healthy move towards it, in the public, in public opinion, maybe leading the political world on this, and that is that I don't want extraordinary means of keeping me alive when I'm dying. And likewise with early, with very premature babies, regardless of the cost, I think the worst place to do it is either one, government mandating that we're going to cut off this, and number two, that we're going to do it by insurance policy where we make some very short-sighted decisions. We very much ration healthcare in this country, but we don't ration it in a rational way. And when Oregon, a number of years ago, tried its, in a sense, rationing of its medical assistance program, the biggest concern I had about that was not that they made some decisions. If the public is making a decision that, well, you know, we don't want to fund this, I think the public can make some of those decisions, but when they do it with medical assistance, they are taking, that's not us, that's those people that we don't want to pay for. And then I'm very wary of that, because you're going to have people deciding, well, in order to save money, we're going to do this. If we're all under the same health plan, if I'm making a decision on, well, I don't think that this kind of experimental or extremely expensive coverage is worth doing, I better be under the same category as you and everybody else here, and then we treat it the same. If we're going to do it for low-income people, we draw the line a lot different place. But if I had $1 million to provide health care to a group of people, and I don't know how many people you can cover for $1 million, but if you were to make those decisions, I think we would definitely favor more preventive care, more universal access, more early interventions for things, and less of the money spent at the what some of us might call mechanical life, where somebody's brain dead or has very little chance. An infant, let's suggest one that's not premature but who's born without a major portion of their brain and brain stem missing or something, and they cannot live on their own without a machine. Those are, again, very difficult, I'd say, ethical issues that I'm not sure I'd want a group of politicians, no offense to a group of politicians, but I wouldn't want us to be determining that, and would much rather see we set up a system for doing it that covers us all the same way and not one that picks out people here, or the way we do it now, where most often is health insurance companies who make a lot of care decisions, not based on health logic, but based on their economic logic.
I am.
If the system's fair, people can live with it. If it's done for certain people, you're not going to have them. Other questions? We can go different directions to Mark.
We had sort of a spirited time here the other night, listening for a couple of nights to some tapes depicting the opinions of Noam Chomsky, who pretty much admits to being an anarchist. And the heart of his plea or approach, it seems to me, is that we no longer have reliable sources of information on major public questions because the providers of the information are all so deeply compromised by their own self-interest that it's just almost impossible to trust that we can get a fair picture of real issues. And it seems to me that's what's undercutting for average middle-class folk, that's what's undercutting confidence in government, is we're not sure how to get around, we're not sure how to get good information. I mean, representative government, we're tending away from that towards direct government. You know, how long will it be before we get rid of you guys in the middle and just vote through our computers on major state questions? But I'm interested in authors that you, over your years, have begun to trust as rational voices in public policy debate, and some recommendations of sources you've learned to trust.
Okay. Well, first of all, Chomsky's a lot more of a pessimist about democracy, as he admits it, than I would be. And I will, the one thing I'll agree with him on is first of all, interests and money definitely drive the system. I would not go as far as he would to say that news media is covering, I'm not sure he says it this way, but he's bought off, and they're writing news stories and covering political things in order to slant the news in a certain way. I mean, I have suspicions about a certain station in the Twin Cities and perhaps talk radio. I'm not sure that I'd go so far as suggesting there's a conspiracy of people who are trying to get a certain agenda, that they're that owners are trying to steer the reporting in their newspapers and so on. But nevertheless, there clearly our whole system is set up in a way that's driven by money. And when our biggest newspaper in Minnesota pushes certain issues where they have financial interest in it in their editorial writing, that bothers me significantly. And yet their reporters have done a good job of covering the other side of the issue too. So I'd say that the media being bought, in a sense, is not as big of a concern to me as the fact that the media is lazy, too interested in giving the people what they want. They will complain that politicians are too much, they have the courage to stand for anything. All they try and do is curry favor with the public. They want to give them tax rebates in election years and do all these things, and they want to do it. Well, the media, they even acknowledge when they say, well, how will they choose stories? Well, we're only doing what the people want. Well, the same thing they're criticizing public officials. They're being very lazy and very unhelpful to a democracy in doing it. And they try and make little stabs at it, but it's tokenism at times. So I have serious questions about the way the media covers things, and believe they do have an obligation in a democracy that they're not fulfilling. I also think Chomsky probably feels some of the same about the impact of money in politics in other ways, the buying of the process. And again, I wouldn't say I've hesitated in the past, so I'm becoming more and more willing to use the word corrupt, because I don't think the people in it intend to do corrupt things with the money. It's not like interest group A goes to politician B and says, here's $1,000 in cash in this envelope I'm handing you under the table, vote for this. Because I don't think there are many politicians in any state, well, the ones I'm familiar with in Minnesota particularly, I don't think there are many politicians who would do anything other than run out of the room in horror if somebody tried to hand them cash in exchange for a vote. Nevertheless, the system is very corrupting, even if they're honest people in the system, in the sense that money drives elections, money drives the political debate at the Capitol, money drives every part of the process, and people have a right to be angry about it and to want to change it. Other half of your question, authors, I hesitate to say any one like book type of author. I guess certain journalists, again, the ones I'm paying the most attention to these days are specific to state journalism, to our state issues. And in terms of national writers, I mean, I guess reading columns is something you tend to find the people who have something to say that you think they're coming from a perspective that you're concerned about and who make some sense. I mean, there are thousands of people who help illuminate what's going on. I don't know if that's not really an answer to it, but I'm not sure how to answer that one. In other words, there's not one person, oh, this person really sheds a lot of light on the system. I'm trying to think of the couple of books. The group from the Philadelphia Inquirer who had written a couple of books about 4 years ago on the economy in America and who runs America or something like that. Those were helpful. But I mean, there are thousands of things that are positive. It's just there's no systematic way of getting information out.
For those of us from Minnesota, who are those columnists or journalists that you...
I like, and again, this is, again, I can name one or two. Doug Groh in the Star Tribune tends to pick out little scandals here and there that, or outrages, I guess they're not scandals, they're outrages about what happens and why it happens. I was working on a drunk driving bill, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving, who had been working on it when we got beat on the issue, they sent out a press release, and I kind of cringed a bit because they just accused the realtors of being corrupt and everything else, because the realtors sent out a thing saying that this was going to cause property taxes to go up. It was a bizarre argument. I think the opposite was true. And they sent out a press release, and I was cringing because the language was vicious. I mean, it was bizarre, and Doug Groh saw the thing, and he talked to him, and he called me on it because it was my bill, and what did I think? And I said, well, you know, I cringed when I saw the language, but the Realtors Association, I don't know why they got involved in this, and it was really unfair what they did. And so he wrote a wonderful column sort of exposing what happened. And there are lots of times, I guess I'll say one column here, one something there that really zings it, but I guess I don't see one writer who is a lot better. And some of the people, one of my disappointments with the media is some of the reporters who I think understand things best, they don't have enough objectivity. They think they're being objective, but they're not necessarily. And sometimes they go so far to bend over backwards to people they would agree with that they are unwittingly basically not giving them a fair shake. And I remember in a gubernatorial campaign a couple of years ago, the first story one of the best writers for the Star Tribune had, who was covering my entrance into the race, it wasn't an announcement, he found out I was running, put it in there, and he asked me some of the things that I was talking about, and I wasn't planning to be public about it at the time, and so I talked with him about some of the things I was doing. He wrote an article, John Murray wants to spend a lot of money on a bunch of social programs. And I said, you know, I thought that was grossly unfair. And he wants to raise taxes to do it. Wonderful. Why don't you talk about, you know, my opponent couldn't have phrased it better. And what about the fact that, you know, here's what I was trying to do. I was trying to invest in early childhood education and in early childhood nutrition. I was going to try and invest in early intervention for troubled kids with mental health, chemical dependency problems, a whole range of things. And how these things, and told him how, you know, this thing has been pretty clear evidence. It saves $3 for every buck we put into this child nutrition program, and that I think we can save taxpayers money by doing this. Mm-hmm. So he writes down, he didn't list any one program, he said a bunch of social programs, or numerous social programs, which is the new code word for welfare programs, which is devastating. And not a talk about, I told him afterwards, I spent 15 minutes with him before he wrote the story, and an hour with him the next day saying, well, I thought it was unfair. You're going to raise taxes for this? Well, you know, the least you could do is give my argument, saying you could report it. You could even, if you think it's a dumb argument, you could even say, Marty wants to raise taxes on a few high-income people in order to get money to pay for child nutrition and other programs that he claims are going to save money. No, he wouldn't even do that. He put the worst possible spin on it. I think he's a very bright reporter and everything else. It was grossly unfair. It's exactly what my opponent would say about me. And basically this is the kind of reporter who likes it when a politician will tell you the whole truth and not just, I'm going to do this. One of my opponents in the primary was, yeah, he favors everything I favor. He wants to invest in early childhood this, and he wants to invest in this, and he wants to invest in this. He wants to do this, but he's going to cut taxes too. Is that consistent? Well, he got good coverage because he cared about the right things. And, well, I learned with certain reporters, you phrase things a little bit differently. And I would have, again, focused on a number of other things, because if they're not going to give you a fair shake, mm-hmm. you find a different way around it. You're not stupid. You don't beat your head against the wall anymore. Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a chance that they've drugged themselves down along with the image of politicians?
Journalists have not done themselves a lot of favors. The public opinion of journalists has gone down significantly.
Like these persons.
And I know in the state's largest paper, which I mentioned several times, they endorsed my opponent in the gubernatorial race. Again, it was one of those things, I didn't expect the endorsement. And I actually called the reporter, the editorial writer who I knew wrote the thing, because one of the things she had written was that Marty was being politically naive in trying to win points by not, I didn't accept large contributions, nothing over $100, no PAC, no lobbyist money. Self-imposed restriction, which makes it much more difficult to raise money. And she wrote this thing in the editorial saying one of the reasons that they couldn't support me was I was politically foolish, because I had already earned as many points as I could earn on that issue by having carried some significant reform legislation. And therefore, I was stupid to tie my hands behind my back on this. And I called her up and said, Lori, you know, this is not really fair. You act as if the only reason a politician, you don't believe this, I know you don't, because it's a good report, a good editorial writer, you don't believe that politicians do or should do everything just for political points. You believe they should do things because they're the right thing to do. Now, I happen to think it's the right thing to do to take the big money out of politics. She said, well, John, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with $1,000 contributions. So $100 is ridiculous. I said, that's your position. I happen to think $100 is a lot, and that's the most it should be. And you're telling me, because you don't think so, that I should sell out myself and do what you think is right, otherwise I'm politically naive. Well, how do you deal with a media like that? It's a good person. And I think the media, then the governor a year later goes out and says about this extreme left-wing newspaper, I thought, boy, I wouldn't have minded one nice editorial out of this extreme left-wing newspaper that endorsed him and everything else. But he knows, you bash the media, bash the media, bash the media. And I hope my portrayal of it tonight is, I think they're falling down on the job, but I don't think they're dishonest or corrupt or that they do a terrible job. They just don't do enough of the right thing. But still, you can bash the media and run against the media, and it wins you points. And the media actually covers you bashing them, because it's a controversy. So it's a good winning point, and I'm not afraid to criticize them, but you got to be a little balanced in it. Yeah. Go ahead, Jen.
How can you keep your faith and still be in politics?
How can you keep your faith and still be in politics? I've been in the legislature for 11 years, and it's without a doubt the most frustrating job, the most discouraging job I've ever had, but at the same time, it's the most rewarding job I've ever had. There are times when you feel you're climbing up a hill that you're never going to get to the top of, and we never will. You feel you're slipping backwards more than you're moving forward. And so, yes, it's very easy to get discouraged. I guess religious faith is something I see as a plus because it gives us hope. And I think I need hope, and there are many times when there are a lot of people who feel strongly about the same sorts of issues I do, who don't get involved in politics at all because it's too frustrating. And people who I know who have been in the legislature, who care deeply about things, and they drop out because it's too frustrating. They get burned out. And I say that the faith and that we have and the hope you get from it is a big plus in terms of renewing. And hey, I'm here because I do get burned out some too. But I think the other thing I do to keep you know, I'm not sure which way you intended, but keep faith in the political system and faith in making sense and continuing to try and push, I think we all do well if we pick out heroes. And not, again, not thinking people who everything about them was perfect. You can find flaws in anybody, but I think of activist or two, one individual who has worked on every wonderful thing that I've ever cared about. Sometime in his life he spent years fighting for it, usually losing battles. He's involved as a political activist. He would never run for office or anything, but he's fought for years on these things. And whenever I feel like I'm frustrated or I'm working harder than anyone else, and so I just remember a couple people like that individual, and remember, if I stop working on the issues, it's all the more push for somebody like that. And so their strength gives me strength. And I think you got to recognize other people count on you for what you do. Whatever your role is in the process, other people count on you. And I think that helps a lot in terms of giving stick-to-itiveness. And I am a persistent person. Some would say stubborn, right?
Talk about the Defense of Marriage Act.
Sure.
And whether you see there's any, whether you have any hope of it being repealed in the future. Is it an educational issue? Is it just more fear and gut reaction? Or where are things as far as legislature?
Good. This will be the last formal question because I think it'll be the end of the hour. Then I'm happy to stay around and keep the conversation going if people want. The Defense of Marriage Act, which I assume everybody knows what it is because most states and the federal government have been touching it. And the first thing I'll say about it is it's largely irrelevant as a substantive issue. And it's being used to push a certain agenda, and it's, though I'm not going to say everybody who pushes it are trying to stir up hatred, it does have the effect of doing that. The reason I say it's about the least significant political issue is Minnesota, where we passed a Defense of Marriage Amendment this year, already has on the law books that marriage is between a man and a woman. I mean, it's defined in law that it couldn't be clearer. But because the Hawaiian Supreme Court had ruled that the Hawaiian Constitution said that you could have marriages between same-sex couples, and therefore if somebody who was married in Hawaii would move to Minnesota under federal constitutional recognition of contracts from other states, they would recognize it. So despite our law against it, it could conceivably happen that you'd have a same-sex couple marriage in Minnesota, married in same-sex family in Minnesota. And in the same way that Minnesota bans marriages between first cousins, and some states do not. And so if somebody, some first cousins get married in, I don't know where they are, Idaho, let's say, and they move to Minnesota, it would happen. And would there be a flood of gay couples moving to Hawaii if Hawaii doesn't change their constitution, which they're in the process of doing? No, because the Commerce Clause does not allow people to violate state laws, to go around them, circumvent them by going to another state to get married and then come back. It doesn't cover that. It's only if you were from another state, a bona fide action in another state. So it's an irrelevant issue. But it was being pushed because people realize, and I argued and I spoke on the Senate floor on the issue, the thing that I objected to most was the title of it, calling it the Defense of Marriage Act. Connie and I have been married almost 17 years. We made a lifelong commitment, I believe a religious commitment, and more than a civil commitment, I take the religious commitment first. And I don't think my marriage needs to be defended against somebody else wanting to partake of the same institution. And on top of that, calling this thing a defense of marriage when we're trying to prohibit others from doing the same things, it seemed to me to be more an attempt to rile up the public about something they do not understand. And I confess, as somebody who is heterosexual, I don't understand homosexuality. I think the people who most are concerned about homosexuals converting other people to it are probably people with bisexual tendencies who may have some feelings both ways, which is one who doesn't, you know, I can't understand homosexual attraction. And actually, was it a thing at Holden 6-7 years ago, Barry, somebody, I can't think of his name, who's since gone to Central America or elsewhere, he was telling it in a way that I really, really, I thought I've used a number of times to describe how we understand people who are heterosexual, understand homosexuality. And he described it as his brother and sister-in-law were talking about heterosexual intercourse with their 8, 9, 10-year-old daughter for the first time, and her reaction was, ooh, gross! and you can understand that. She didn't have any feelings towards it. It's hard to understand. And the same thing about somebody who doesn't have those feelings that way. So I think that's, I don't know if it's education or it's something that's going to take years to educate people on, but I guess the thing that bothers me is that I think it was the impact of it, whatever the intent was to stir up a lot of hatred and a lot of misunderstanding. And in Minnesota, nobody in the gay community who was active in any way, shape, or form politically was pushing for anything like gay marriages. Nobody was pushing for it. And I used to, the letters I sent out to people on it, and some people who I think are very good, very honest, decent, sincere people had contacted me in opposition in support of it. And I said, you know, first of all, from the civil side of things, I've been spending more time trying to get rid of our marriage penalties in tax law than I am concerned that somebody else wants to suffer the same consequence. But to show how carried away this was, after I drafted this letter, one of the author of the Defense of Marriage Act came in there, and since he hadn't been able to get a vote, which I think was unfair, because it is a legitimate issue to debate, but he wanted to find it somewhere. He was trying to find a bill it was germane to so he could bring it up on the floor, and he found one, the tax bill. So he said, regardless of any other thing, if there's for purposes of tax law, you cannot have a family. You cannot have a married couple marriage between people of the same sex. No other law. So in other words, if we didn't pass DOMA, and if somebody lived in Hawaii, got married, moved to Minnesota, they would be recognized as a married family under our acceptance of other contracts. But because he was able to pass that amendment under his amendment, they would not be allowed to suffer the marriage tax penalties, which was the exact opposite. I mean, he was giving special treatment or special preferences, as he uses, to a certain group that he doesn't like. And I thought that pointed out very well what the agenda is. It's to deal with something that there's great difficulty in understanding. But first of all, on civil purposes, why we should tell people that when their partner or somebody they love, I don't care if it's a sibling or a partner in a homosexual relationship or some other relationship where two people want to be involved when somebody's dying and making the decisions, that they shouldn't be in there in every way. And that if they want to make a lifelong commitment, our laws shouldn't prohibit it. And I don't care if we call it marriage or partnership or something else, let them do what they want. In terms of the religious aspect of it, part I consider most important, I don't like the government telling churches who they can and cannot marry. And here we're saying you may not marry these people regardless of your religious convictions, and I frankly think that's a decision the churches should make on their own. And in a number of states, and probably in Minnesota, they call things marriages, even if they're not recognized by the state. And then finally, the most important thing on it, I'd say, is I want to encourage commitment. People, for whatever reason, they want to make commitments, lifelong commitments, in good times and bad. And I want to see that. And the people who criticize the gay community for a lot of promiscuity, which is certainly out there, I mean, in heterosexual and homosexual communities, it's out there. But for those who criticize the gay community because there certainly may be a higher percentage of promiscuous behavior, seeing that this one attempt by some members of the community to make commitments, that we're going to say, we don't care, we're not going to let you. I don't care if you call it marriage or partnership or what, but I think we ought to be encouraging people to make commitments anyway. But it is it's 80% oppose it. I mean, support DOMA and oppose oppose gay marriages. So it's politically, it's not an easy one, but I'm more concerned about the effect of it than I am, not the effect on people's attitudes than I am on whether it changed the law, because it didn't. So I'll call it quits there because our hour's up, but I'm happy to stay around informally and talk more.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Martin, we didn't even get to the issue.